All right, welcome to iTool for IT Pros, Building for Operations. My name is Nathan Lesnowski. I am the Infrastructure Practice Director at Concurrency. I've had the opportunity over the last several years to spend a lot of my time working in IT service management. IT service management is really all about what is it that we do as IT professionals. We provide a service to our organizations. And today, we're going to be talking about how we do that in an extraordinary way. In all the other sessions that you're going to be in, you're going to see an extreme focus on technology. And that's good. That's a really interesting thing. In this session, our principal focus is going to be on process. And the reason it's going to be on process is because process is what's going to enable you to be an excellent IT professional and not just a good one. I'm certain that if you take the content from this presentation, you bring this back to your business, and you put this into action, it's going to make a more substantial impact than any of the technologies that you learn this week. So let's get started. Whose company sees them like this? A big black box that gets fed money. In fact, I probably could have made like five or six of those dollar signs because it just keeps going in. I'd like to buy a new SAN. I'd like to buy this new hypervisor stack. I'd like to buy this new service. I need to have these consultants come in and help me with stuff. When I first got into IT, one of my mentor would always tell me about how he'd have to go to the business owner and talk about these technology topics, and he never really got it, right? What's interesting is the business is starting to get it. They're starting to understand that technology is an important part of their business. The problem is that we haven't really gone along for that ride. You heard Brad Anderson and a bunch of the other folks from Microsoft talking about cloud, 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 right? Do you think that in your business they see IT as the mechanism to deliver excellent cloud services? Or do you think when they think cloud, they think, I don't have to put as much money into that big black box? Yup, that's exactly what they think, right? They think, that big black box is too big. They don't know how big it should be, mind you, right? They just know, it's too big of a black box, and I don't want to put money into it anymore, so I'm going to go to Microsoft for Office 365, and I'm going to start putting my virtual machines in Azure because I can get them for $125 a month, and I'm going to start consuming CRM online and so on. And those may actually be the right decisions. But the problem is that because IT is a black box, they can't differentiate between the right decision and a decision. Sure, they might move some things to the cloud, but you might find that moving those things to the cloud might not be the right choice in certain circumstances because the vendor that you're putting those services with isn't an appropriate vendor. But they would have never come to you because they're going around IT. They're not going through IT. So this session is about how we can make you as an IT service professional a service provider and not a black box. Does that sound good? Yeah? All right. So let's take a step back. I'm going to challenge you to reimagine how you deliver IT. If you were going to start from scratch, let's pretend you have no servers, you have no computers in your office, you're starting a new business, and in that day one, you're going to have 1,000 employees. How would you deliver IT? We're going to put on some practical service improvement classes. One of the things I see in the process training space is you got a lot of these textbook Tommies out there. When I think of a textbook Tommy, I think of the guy who knows how to teach a concept of ITIL, but doesn't really know how it gets implemented within a business. So we're going to try to put on some practical service improvement classes, not just service improvement classes. And I'm going to want you to come out of each section with one idea. The framework that we're going to be using for this conversation is ITIL V3. some of the background that you may be coming into this session with is ITIL V2. ITIL V2 was very focused on individual aspects of IT. What you're going to notice is this is going to take a little bit different of an idea. And I think it aligns really well with the cloud. At its core, ITIL is about service. We are service providers. We are service providers to our business where they consume services from us to help run the business. So when the business comes to us and says, I want email services from you. I want you to deliver an ability for me to communicate with the outside world through email. We're a service provider for perhaps an outside service. We're a conduit for them to be able to get that service. So the first thing you need to do is stop thinking about computers and servers and racks and all these little intricacies of IT. They're important, right? But you need to focus first on the service that you intend to offer to your customers in the business and what that service is. Focus on what you deliver, and then you continuous service improvement around it. What is a service? A service is something that I deliver to the business. It could be almost anything that I deliver to the business. So a way to think about that something would be maybe customer ordering services, collaboration services, public marketing, communication. Notice there isn't a product name in any of those services, right? Because email is an interesting example. What I've seen in my time being an IT professional is that we went from having Exchange 5.5, Exchange 2000, Exchange 2003, 2007, 2010, 2013. Then we moved to Office 365. What would happen if that was the way in which I communicated it to my users? Well, they get stuck on products instead of focusing on the value I'm delivering to them. Using a service allows me to measure it over time, allows me to communicate the value that I'm bringing to them versus a technology that I'm bringing to them. Collaboration services, warehouse automation, public marketing. It gets you thinking about things that you help the business deliver, not just a server that sits in a rack that you're operating at any given point. If you start going back, and if I were to stop the presentation right now and walk out, that'd be kind of odd, right? Like that'd be really interesting if I did that. But if I stopped the presentation right now and walked out, I would hope that you going back to your business and simply starting to talk about services rather than talking about servers and racks and databases would change the way you work. So ITIL, as a framework, is built to define a life cycle around which the services we offer to the business runs. It's broken up into five pieces. It starts with strategy, which is where we define what it is that we want to deliver to the business, and also define the architectures from which we intend to deliver those services to the business. So if you said, my strategy is to put all new infrastructure in Azure. It doesn't define the actual design of the service in Azure, but it does define your goal, your next step, your interest, where you want to take it. Strategy also might be, there's a value in my business implementing a customer ordering service. I would make a lot more money if my business had a customer ordering service for them to buy my product off my public website than for them to have to come to my store. It's a conversation about that. Then that same service moves to design, where you say, okay, cool. I want to take that service and I want to design it so when I put it into production, it functions and it runs well. And then I kick off a project and I move to transition. Transition is about taking that service that I built in a project and moving into operations. Transition then hands off to operations, which is where we kind of think about IT, right? I think what a lot of businesses believe is that IT is only the fixer of broken things. That's why when I go into companies and talk about things like service manager, they say, oh, that's the ticket tracking system. You're tracking tickets, right? Things that are busted, things that don't work right, that's the black box, right? IT, not only is IT this place where we pour all our money, but it's also the place where all the complaints come out, So it consumes a lot of money, a lot of complaints come out, and they need a ticket tracking system. We're not speaking like the business, and we need to. And then we move to continuous improvement, which I think is one of the most powerful things that we can do. All right, so five questions. Strategy. Do I know what I deliver to the business? Do I even know? Most companies I interact with, if I said, do you have a list of the services, the things that you deliver to the business? Why is the organization paying for your job? They don't have that list. So the first thing you do is you sit down as a group and you say, okay, I'm going to make a list of all the things that I deliver to the business and why I'm here. The reason they're paying me to come to work every day is because I deliver a value to them. As things move out of my data center, I'm still delivering a value to the business. I certainly am. But I need to articulate that to them because they may not get it. They may think when I moved off to 65 for email, I no longer need my exchange administrators anymore. Well, fat chance. A lot of times you still need those people, right? Because they're delivering a value that allows for that system to function. So you need to articulate what it is that I'm delivering to the business and what we do to support it. Design is, can I reconcile the choice that I make, or did a consultant just come in and tell me what it is I should be doing? Transition is, how did my last deployment go from production or into production from my project? So I have a project, it comes up with a release. Maybe I don't even have a release. Maybe I just deploy stuff. How did that last patch go? How did the last service pack go? Did I take down the business when I did it? Did people know I was going to take down the business when I did it? Sometimes I know the extent to which companies have good change management. When I walk in at night, they say, oh, don't worry, just reboot it. Nobody will know. It's lunchtime. Like, that worked fine when we were, like, you know, 150 people, but maybe not quite as well when we're larger, right? Operations, do my customers know what to expect from me? What I found is that customers don't always need 99.99999999% availability. What they need is to have expectations around when they can have availability. They need expectations around when they can have availability, not just high availability. Okay, so service strategy. So service strategy starts off by talking about what we do. What we do is our portfolio. Portfolio is a service portfolio. So a service portfolio articulates the things we deliver to the business and its business relationship. The what do we do? Also, the what does it cost? So it doesn't mean I'm necessarily defining what it is that the to-be system is going to be, but it might talk about what the current system is. So if I have a paper process and I'm going to replace it with a technology process, what does that cost relationship look like? Can I articulate that? If I can't, it probably means I don't have good enough data. So how can I get better data? And that's when we get all the way around the circle and get back to continuous service improvement. That's where we should be at. I should be able to articulate cost. Demand. Can I deliver what it is that they're asking me to deliver? One of the things I experience a lot as a consultant is I go into an organization, and it takes them 6 weeks to get me servers when I ask for them. I'm like, 6 weeks? Like, how can it possibly take me 6 weeks to get a server? Like, what are you doing over there, twiddling your thumbs? It's because they have no concrete process for managing demand. They got to their maximum capacity, they need to add a new host, they need to wait for the host to get wired, and they need to manage this as sort of like this response mechanism. And then also architecture. Architecture is really where you're moving. One of the things that you're seeing a lot from Gartner and seeing a lot in the industry is that the jobs that people are moving into are automation and PowerShell, architecture around cloud platforms, so how all things fit together, and defining frameworks in which we work as organizations. So these jobs are starting to change, and architectures are a very important part of it. Okay, so how do these all fit together? So the first thing you should see here is you need to determine what you do, define the architectures. On the left-hand side, you can see that we have an idea. The idea is something I want to deliver to the business, right? That converges with the overall strategy of the business. I might have an idea that's a not particularly bright idea. It might be a less bright idea, let's say. And then it converges with business strategy, which is saying that's maybe not a great idea. And then architecture, which is, yes, I'd like this to be a paper process. And you're like, I just don't think a paper process is the way to go anymore, guys. So these things combine together into an identified service. Then you're saying, well, whoa, but I got all this stuff I deliver now. Like, there's all these things. I don't have time to worry about strategy. I've got all this stuff I deliver now, and they want to move it to the cloud. Well, you know what you start with? You start with the backlog. And you go through a backlog process of identifying the service you deliver, and you flow them through this process. I guarantee you that if you start this, it will change the way you work. So you select your service, move to service design, and it hands off to the project process. So the project process is like its own little thing. So think about this as like a circle in which your operational process is running, and on the other side, you've got this sort of converging circle where you have the project process, which is how do we deliver something, build it, and then hand it off to production. So getting started. I'm going to convey that you should start this as simple as possible. This is not a technology problem, folks. This is a process problem. I love technology. In fact, I'm a technologist at heart. I love working with technology. I love PowerShell. I love SMA. I love playing with all these interesting things. But unless I know what I want to do, I'm kind of floating around. So what I would suggest is you start with a SharePoint list. Could be Excel, I suppose, if you wanted to do that. But I would start with a SharePoint list, and you'll see why. Start a steering committee in your business. If you don't have one, be that person who steps up and says, look, we need to do a better job of defining what it is we deliver to the business and why. The CIO will be, or maybe not even the CIO, but the CEO would be like, wow. Now, this is a guy who actually understands my business. He's not just a guy who wants to run technology stuff. Meet monthly to perform service reviews. So have a reoccurring pattern under which you meet. Don't just make it whenever you feel like it. Make it a reoccurring pattern. Reoccurring patterns are the secret to implementing any process. Implement the reoccurring pattern with the correct controls, not just controls that are for this way we do it, this day we do it one way, this way we do it another way. Building controls that you can live by. And then synchronize that SharePoint list into the service manager CMDB or your service management tool of choice. Obviously, I would suggest Service Manager. That's the tool I live and die by. But you could certainly synchronize that into other tools if you have them right now. Project process and architecture tool also relate into this. Okay, so this is sort of a funny demo, right? Because it's not really a technology demo as much as it is just showing you an example of what this can look like. Okay, so this is a SharePoint list. But what it is an example of conversations that we have as a business. So let me give you an example here. We have fizzy lifting drinks. Kirk Poser, who's one of our salespeople, he suggested that we have a service called fizzy lifting drinks. And fizzy lifting drinks is a soda which will cause people to float into the air. Unfortunately for us, it isn't going to bring a whole lot of business revenue. So it's one of these things that we're going to leave in envisioning until it becomes something that we might want to do. Or we'll just decide this is not something that we're really interested in. On the other hand, customer ordering services, which has an opportunity for customers to be able to come through and actually purchase our products online, has a business revenue associated with it. It has hours saved per year, and it has a relatively small capital cost. It also has an existing service that it replaces. So the idea with this is to spin up. This probably took me 5 minutes to spin up this site. Okay? Not very complex. But what it does provide you the opportunity to do is it gives you the opportunity to be able to say, look, now we've got a tool in which we're working to be able to have this conversation. I found that once you spin up these sites and you start having a meeting about it, it starts changing the way people think. And it starts having you act in a way which is more towards a service-oriented architecture. Over time, everything you deliver to the business will be listed here. This list gets synchronized into the Service Manager CMDB. So the Service Manager CMDB can be read through Orchestrator's integration pack. This happens to live in Office 365. So Office 365 has a SharePoint list. We read that into the Service Manager CMDB. as we spin up new services or they flow through the life cycle, from the first idea to their death, we have that service captured. And we can talk about what it is that we're delivering to the business. Some of the most successful IT service management programs in the world are based off of simple SharePoint lists that start the conversation. Everybody in this room can do this. You don't need significant technology to get that done. Okay. Service design. Service design is taking the intent and putting it into reality. Okay? The intent to reality. So the idea is I'm taking a customer ordering service, and I'm deciding that I'd like to actually build that customer ordering service. So we're gathering our requirements. We're looking at our architectural model. So in the previous stage, I had said architectural model is put everything in Azure as an application as a service. So all my applications that I build need to go there. And this is how they're going to talk on premise, through this particular VPN repository. And then create a design for the service. Here's some examples of parts that would be in this design. It's called a service design package. This is the official ITIL term for it, service design package, SDP. And it contains the design itself, the technical components of the architecture, the criticality, its relationship to other services. So is this a business critical application or is it a convenience application? We're not always going to do business critical applications, right? Some of the things are convenience applications. For example, we have a project in our organization where they want to put a signature manager on my signature. And it's something we're doing for marketing, but it's not necessarily going to prevent us from working. So just because it isn't a high criticality project doesn't mean it's not important. It's just something we're delivering that's going to allow us to benefit the business. We have our primary owner and contacts. The primary owner is the buck stops here decision maker on the service. So if I'm spinning up a customer ordering application, who's my buck stops here person on that service who's going to really understand it and is going to own it as a deliverable for the business? And he's going to say, look, my career at this company is going to be based upon whether or not we do a really good job on customer ordering. And if we succeed at this, I want it to be known that I help succeed in this particular area. That's the primary owner, right? He's going to help make this service a success. If nobody's going to step up in that space, then maybe the service isn't worthwhile. And then contacts and end users. Contacts would be people who help support it. End users, of course, are people who are receiving the service. It may even be external people. So you may just have a way of articulating those external people. Availability requirements. When does this need to be available? When doesn't it need to be available? If you ask the business when this application needs to be available, what are they going to say? All the time, right? We need it all the time. You know why they say all the time? Because they don't know, right? They don't know what they need. They kind of have this vague idea of what they need. And also, they don't necessarily trust IT to give it to them. So they've got a dual problem. They know that they kind of need it a lot, and they don't necessarily trust IT to give it to them because IT doesn't have great control over what they're delivering to the business either. So you have this kind of dual problem. And then capacity requirements as well. What is it that we need in the system against our overall capacity of our environment? So how do you get started? In order for a project to start in your organization, put in these three things. The service has to be approved through the service strategy. If it hasn't been approved through the service strategy, then don't start the project. You might have some pushback on that initially, right? But I think what you'll find is that if you start with that strategy, you're going to make a difference. You have to have an SDP defined. Now you're going to find you have a lot of existing services, right? That's where you go back through your backlog to define the SDPs for your existing services. And the design must be validated with architecture. That's probably the hardest part, especially in gigantic organizations that have an architecture team. They find that organizational elements will actually go around architecture. We put this process in place to help define that. And the reason why is because when it doesn't go through here, we can't prove it's having a business value. And we also can't prove that we're not going to have to replace it later. Okay. So let's talk through how this relates. Okay. So these are my services that I just finished showing. And interior to these are some of the other elements that I didn't show. So we've got things like our envisioning site, our replacing existing service, our service owner, our tier two service that it bubbles up to. So for example, this bubbles up to a tier two service called customer engagement. It relates to an architecture called .NET Custom Application. So we've defined these standards against which we're working, and then we've applied those to the back end of our gating process. So as we bring services into the business, it allows us to gate them and control them. So you can see where things like email bubbles up to communication services, right? Our desktop bubbles up to personal computing services. This is where services start to form a hierarchy and not just a one tier. Usually we start with a three-tier hierarchy of services that allows us to get up to a very large sort of big bucket decision point space and then go all the way back down into the small decision space. So what happens then is that this then relates to a business service in your CMDB. So this is System Center Service Manager. System Center Service Manager contains a database called Configuration Management Database, CMDB. In ITIL-V3, it's actually multiple CMDBs. And in the business services space, you can see some of the different services I've requested. You can see ones that are in service, and also see ones that were requested or in envisioning state. So the idea is that this is always consistent with that initial request. And inside of email services, we see that we're synchronizing our service owner, our classifications, and also our service components get built out. So as we deploy the service into production, do a design, allocate it in our design through the project into the operational process, these service components relate to that service itself. And then it also then relates to the work data. So when we get into operations, incidents, and change requests all relate to the same service. So the idea behind this is it provides us one flexion point or one aggregation point against which all the operational processes hit. But it started its strategy. The next part of the process is called service transition. Service transition is we've built a design, we have a design, we've gone through a project to build out the system, and now we're feeding into the operational process. We're launching it into production. Imagine like you are the flight crew on the Apollo 13 mission, and you've got this sort of command center, right? This is where all the pre-flight checks happen. This is where all the validation for your launch happens. This is where all the timing happens. So what I find is there's a couple different types of organizations. One type of organization does changes whenever they feel like it. The other type of organization does it underneath what's called iron fist change management. And what I look for is somewhere in between those two spaces, right? So if we've got iron fist change management and we've got do whatever the heck I feel like, somewhere in between there is the right space for our business. And that's where we can kind of break this down. And I'll show you the different change types that will practically help you do that. So if you're really good at planning, you're going to have very successful operational processes. If you're very bad at planning, this is what you start to experience. So I was in a parking lot, and I was looking at this car, and it was surrounded by snow. And I'm like, man, that guy, he didn't do a really good job on service transition because he was stuck. And he got plowed in. And he was there for like 3 months, so maybe he knew he was going to be there. But you understand poor planning by its results. So what I find is that when I go into a company and they can't sit down in a meeting with me because their guys have to keep running out to do firefighting because of the thing they deployed last night, they probably have not a great idea of how to do good service transition, because they're deploying stuff into production without it going through a good testing process. All right, so how do these all fit together? If you think of change management as launch control, change management relates to things you're changing. So in this diagram, what you can see is we have our change, right, in the purple, and then we have our configuration items. And our configuration items could be a server, it could be an application, it could be a service, right? Usually we go for the smallest element that we can track. It doesn't mean go for the smallest element that we can track manually. It means go for the smallest element that we can track automatically. Look for those elements that you can then add to your change record that then bubble up to something that's an aggregation point that lets you make decisions, which would be your service. So that change relates to a configuration item. The configuration item relates to a service. Service could be customer ordering. It could be email services. It could be financial services. This helps you make better decisions because they all relate to each other. Types of changes. There are three principal types of changes that I typically use. The first type of change is called a normal change. It's called a normal change because it's normal. It's the type of change that requires a gating process. So a gating process would be a change advisory board meeting. So it'd say, if you want to deploy a normal change, this needs to get approved through our CAB. If it doesn't go through the CAB, it doesn't get deployed. Now, a CAB could be one person, but typically it's more than one person. What I find is that normal changes typically look like this. They go through a drafting state, then they go to the primary owner for approval. So the primary owner is the buck stops here person on the service, and their job is to say, this looks like something I can deploy this weekend, or this doesn't look like something I can deploy this weekend. This is not a great change, or this is a great change. Then it goes to the CAB. The CAB's job is not to debate whether or not a change is a relevant change or a bad change or a good change. The CAB's job is to A, make sure that all the changes flowed through the right process, B, to look for collisions, especially doing release management in CABs, looking for collisions between changes and saying, wait, you're modifying the switch this weekend? The core switch? I'm supposed to be doing the exchange upgrade this weekend. Those two people might not have been communicating if not for a CAB meeting. CAB meetings also introduce structure. When you have structure, it helps you prepare. So I know that whenever I have structured meetings that I need to prepare for, I do a better job of being ready to serve in that sense, in that customer engagement, in that meeting, in that deployment. An emergency change is the complete opposite of a normal change. The emergency change is, this is probably going to cause a problem. I don't know when it's going to cause a problem, but it probably is going to be now, or the system's already down, and I need to apply it right now. Or, I didn't have time to get stuff done from the normal change meeting, so I'm going to put in an emergency change. Some companies look like that, right? Those are the ones where the CAB doesn't have enough power. So, some companies, they have a CAB, but the CAB is like the sort of informal gathering of people who don't really actually have any kind of control over the change deployment. They're just sort of logging them. The most effective CABs are ones that can actually stop a deployment of a change because they've been empowered by the CIO to do so. And emergency changes then become bad if they're done as a result of poor planning. They become good if it's the result of trying to fix something in production that was caused by some unforeseen circumstance. So emergency changes are high risk. So remember when I talked about the difference between iron fist and like this sort of like do whatever you want in IT kind of space? That's where the standard change fits in. So the standard change is a pre-approved, no-risk change. I've done this 1,000 times. It has no negative impact. It allows me to respond to my customer quickly. And it doesn't need to go through the CAB. It does go through the CAB to get approval to be a standard change. So I say, look, I think that modifying this particular part of this report should not require a normal change request. It should be something that I can apply whenever I feel like it. That's where a standard change comes in. So you'd propose that, and they say, great, this is a standard change. Let's do it. That can then gets added to the standard change list. Do whatever you want. So this kind of control may seem like it's a lot, but I am certain that you'll find that implementing change processes like this will significantly increase the availability of your systems. You'll increase availability significantly more by implementing good change processes than you will by deploying highly available infrastructures. So here's an example of what kind of content goes in a change request. Title, schedule, is it going to cause an outage? Outage is not a maybe, guys, just so you know. I never allow maybes in my outage box. It should be yes or no. Don't allow the wiggle room. If it's going to be an outage, say yes. If it could be an outage, say yes. If it's not going to be an outage, say no. Because we need to communicate with our users, and users hate maybes. Users like definitive understanding of when they're going to be accessing the system and when they can't access the system. Give them guidance, and then they will follow your guidance, hopefully. But they don't follow maybes. They follow yeses and nos. You say, we are having a update applied to our system between 10 and 11 tonight. Between 10 and 11, the system will likely be down for significant periods of time. They're going to be able to respond to that better than, guys, you might see an outage tonight. Maybe. And not tell them anything about it. Do we have a backup plan? And what IT business service does it impact? Those things are really important. Okay. Release management. Release management is like change management on steroids. What it does is it allows for me to be able to manage the deployment of releases of applications or releases of updates or patches into my infrastructure in groups. So, for example, I have a customer that's a web application hoster. And what they do is every weekend they have a release. And that release contains configuration items which are changed. And sometimes those configuration items make it in, sometimes they don't. Sometimes the changes make it in, sometimes they don't. And the idea behind it is that that cycle of releases allows for us to plan for delivering functionality and also planning our change advisory board meetings. So release management is something that you put in place, especially if you have a strong development team. So your development team, in these cases, are developing these applications, and then they're releasing a build, and that build contains components and modifications to CIs that are linked to change requests. And in those businesses that have strong development teams, release management is a very important part of how they do business. In those that don't, you might find that you can accomplish release management within the context of change management without significant additional effort. The concept is what's really important. That releases relate to changes, and that releases change configuration items. Configuration management. Configuration management's the what in service transition. Configuration management should be updated automatically, not manually. So I've been involved in ITILS type stuff for about, I don't know, probably 8 or 9 years. And I remember going to these ITSMF meetings, and they'd be talking about how to maintain your CMDB manually through change control. So they had all these people updating the CMDB through these manual processes every day. I went to a business just recently that was sort of the result of that, and they had 8 people, they had about 30,000 users, they had about 8 people updating their CMDB and asset data manually. Anybody have a guess as a result of that manual data entry? What was that? Bad data, right? So if you had a system that you knew had bad data, would you trust it? No. So I've got 8 employees spending most of their time updating a system with bad data. So I've basically wasted 8 employees' salaries for an entire year putting bad data in a system. So configuration management needs to be something that's maintained through automated data feeds. It cannot be something that's managed through manual data entry. That's where things like Service Manager CMDB are significantly different than just maintaining your own Excel spreadsheets when it comes to talking about configuration management. Cloud resources count as CIs. So some people say like, oh, you know, IT service management's going out the window because we have the cloud now. You don't have to manage anything, you know, it's in Azure. We don't have to do anything with that stuff anymore. So what you'll find is that configuration management databases are actually even more important than when you're talking about the cloud, because it allows for you to define that cloud resource, whether it's a software as a service, an infrastructure service, a platform as a service, whatever it is. The component is still CI. It's something I deliver to the business. So it might be, I have an operating level agreement with Microsoft to deliver Office 365. And that operating level agreement says that they're going to deliver under these particular constraints and these particular requirements for me. Otherwise, there's this financial penalty, right? So the idea is that you're tracking in configuration management those relationships to your external customers. Those can be fed through automated data feeds. Asset management is different than configuration management. Asset management is an entitlement. Configuration management is a configuration item that might relate to an entitlement. So think about it this way. I'm entitled to a particular piece of software because I bought it, but it doesn't mean it's deployed in my environment. That piece of software, let's say it's Microsoft Office, right? Let's say I'm entitled to 250 copies of Microsoft Office. I've deployed 200 copies of Microsoft Office. The CI is the thing that's running that asset, that entitlement. So an asset can be a physical thing, or it can be a software thing, or it could be a warranty or a support agreement, or it could be an external relationship, an external agreement. So this asset relates to, in this case, a retired computer and an active computer. So if I wasn't tracking the configuration item, what you'd find is that configuration item would total up software items, which are wrong. So I have these CIs that total up the software items. And these software items should equate to a deployed software count. Well, if I didn't track the CI as retired, what would happen? What would happen is I'd have an incorrect software count. So they relate to the asset, and the asset then allows for me to say, how many physical computers do I have deployed, or how many pieces of software do I have deployed across my environment that I'm using? And the CI count allows me to be able to get that information. And that asset relationship allows me to know what I have physically. Okay. So let's demo some examples of what I mean by service transition, how this all fits together. Okay, so for this conversation, I'm going to use a technology called Power BI. So what I'm doing with Power BI, this lives in Office 365, okay? So Office 365 there's really two ways to visualize data from the CMDB that I use. One is called PowerView, another is called Power BI. PowerView is an on-premise data visualization technology. Power BI is an Office 365-based data visualization technology. They both are looking at an analysis server that's pulling data from the CMDB. So in this sense, what I've done is I've surfaced information from the CMDB about change requests. So you can see I have a couple different services that I'm offering: business intelligence, collaboration services, connectivity services, customer ordering. And then all of these services impact these different configuration items, and then relate to these actual change requests. So if I were to select, for example, customer ordering, it's going to change my Power BI example. It's going to say, here's the only CI that's impacted as a result of your change, as a priority 6. And these are two releases, each coming on different nights, deployed by the same person. For customer ordering, customer ordering release 1 and 2. And these then allow me to have a consistent change meeting. So I come into change meeting, I say, okay, let's look at our change requests. Customer ordering, what are we doing with customer ordering this week? Okay, looks like we're modifying the customer ordering form, and these are the two releases that we're doing. Cool, all right, sounds good. Maybe they're sitting down and saying, all right, for business intelligence, might be saying, all right, I'm impacting this concurrency SharePoint form. Well, if I select the concurrency SharePoint form, what I can see is, oh, it looks like I actually have two change requests, two services that both use the concurrency SharePoint form. And those two services relate to two changes, both happening at the same time and both having the same start date but run by two different people. So the idea is that I can use this configuration change data to be able to have an effective conversation with my customers or with my other business users about the changes that we're deploying into production. This is grabbed all from the CMDB and allows for me to be able to also surface this in a touch-centric way. So this is a touch interface. Power BI is pretty cool. I can touch my computer, and then it goes to the screen. So this kind of interface actually plays really, really well in big screens in people's data centers or in their IT areas. You can surface this information so people can interact with it and see what's going on. We happen to have a perceptive pixel in our environment, and we surface this data up there, and then we can have a conversation about it. It's pretty useful. Okay. Another example using... Oh, let's reload the report. Something. Okay. All right, I'll come back to that. Another, what's that? Maybe somebody made a change. That's exactly, it's in the cloud, right? So there would definitely be no changes to the environment that I would have to work with. There we go. All right, great. They made a change. They took out the internet. Okay. So these are our database servers. So for example, let's imagine that I'm a database admin. And as a database admin, one of the things that is interesting to me is the database servers that I run and where the databases live. So what I did is I decided that I was going to break these down based upon the servers in my data center. And I could say, all right, which servers run the most databases? And this is coming from my CMDB, right? So my CMDB is using a management pack from Operations Manager to gather all the databases. And then it's synchronizing those databases from SCOM, System Center Operations Manager, into my CMDB. So my CMDB now has a list of all the databases that I run, and then I've surfaced that data through Power BI so anybody can interact with it. So if I'm a database admin, I can say, okay, I want to see all the databases that happen to live on Cincy SQL 1. Or Cincy SQL. And on Cincy SQL, I have this particular database. It runs this particular recovery model. It allows for me to be able to interact and see, okay, here's all the different databases that I might be running there. Or perhaps all the different databases that live on Cincy Staging. I could also take this table and break it down based upon different values. And also select it back up to the top if I want to get the whole list. So the idea is I'm basically surfacing configuration data in a report that allows me to get information I'm interested in. The data that I'm surfacing could be anything in your CMDB. So anything that you find useful could be brought up to this kind of interface. Okay. Service operations. Service operations is it's now in production, and now I need to run it. Which is where everybody kind of starts, right? Because it's the world we're living in. Like, we already have this in place. We're delivering it to the business, and now we've got to actually execute on running it. So they think ticket tracking systems, right? So the idea is we're going to try to do a better job at this. Support the services in production is really what we're delivering. But in many ways, it's the face of IT. The idea behind service operations is this is what someone gets when they call up the phone. So when I call up a service desk, there's two things I hate listening to. One is this sort of like automated message that makes me go through a bunch of like numbers and things I got to listen to and press buttons and so on. One of the first things I do when I start doing IT service management projects is I'd remove that. Because the experience people get is terrible. They immediately don't like dealing with IT because they've got to go to this really annoying phone tree. Then the person who picks up the phone deals with them like they're an annoyance rather than someone they really want to help. And this is what contributes to this IT as a black box syndrome. So incident management is about fixing root cause or providing a workaround. Okay? Problem management is about figuring out the root cause. Okay? So here's the key point. Incident management, we may not always be able to figure out and fix a root cause. An acceptable resolution in incident management is a workaround. Just conceptually, just think about it that way. An acceptable resolution is the workaround. It's the reboot, right? I rebooted the server, and it's back up. That's your workaround. That's incident management. I got something fixed, quote unquote, but it's not the root cause fixed. And it's also about being about customer service. So customer service is being a customer's advocate. So the best, I love it when I call up a company when I'm having a problem, and the person I talk to immediately becomes my advocate and says, I'm going to find out who can help you with this. I might not be able to help you, but I can figure out who will. This is where we're talking about not even like process stuff. This is like the difference between having a really great waiter at a restaurant and a terrible waiter. What happens when you go to a restaurant and you have a terrible waiter? Yeah, you don't leave a tip. Too bad we don't get tips, right? You also don't go back.
That's great.
So our job is to be a customer advocate. It's also routing properly. One of the things I find I'm usually going after in terms of fixing is not just being customer advocates, but also reducing routes. People hate being routed. They hate going from one person to another person to another person because they're like, I already explained this to the phone tree that asked me who I was and what my problem was. And wait a minute, you didn't get that information? And then it goes to the next route, the next route, and the next route. We don't want that. And then following up, building in a follow-up process. So incident management is about being really, really good about service. Priority, what's a priority? Priority is not a subjective term. So when you're doing incident management and you've got this priority drop-down, priority is not a subjective term. Priority is a non-subjective term. It's a combination of two things, impact and urgency. Impact is how big is the issue. So is everybody in my business impacted, or is it just like one or two people? Is it my customers, or is it the accounting department? Like, how big is this issue? Urgency is how bad is the issue. Is everybody's impacted, but they get this little pop-up, and it's not really a big deal, and they're not going to be screaming about it. Whereas I have two people impacted, but they're going to be going into a sales presentation with this new customer, and if I don't fix it for them, we might not get this $3 million project. So there's this sort of differentiation between those two things. So what I find is one of the things we have to work through is how does that decision tree work for us? And the companies that say, well, you know, it's no big deal. Just let them pick from a drop-down. What you're essentially doing then is you're saying, all of my people are going to always be able to make effective choices about how bad something is and how good something is. And what we usually find is that we're better off kind of giving them that decision tree for them, helping them to make better decisions about what's important and what's less important. So I can help define that. It also helps us set expectations. The expectations relate to a service level target. And in service management, it's called SLOs. That's new terms called service level target. And it relates to timing. So you say, a priority one needs to be resolved in 2 hours. A priority two needs to be resolved in 8 hours. Three, a week. Four, 2 weeks. And the idea behind this is it allows us to be able to set expectations with the customer so we can judge whether or not we're delivering successfully. There's nothing necessarily wrong with missing expectations if we then use that in continuous improvement to address those expectations and change what we're promising to our customers. Because the last thing we want to do is just keep promising the wrong thing. If I keep saying I'm going to get this done in 2 hours, but I've never hit it in a P1 scenario, I should probably change it because I'm not going to be able to hit it. Okay, routing. Routing is used in IT service management to get the incident to the right place. And sometimes there's kind of two different schools of thought on this. One is to allow for users to be able, analysts in the service desk, to be able to select the support group that a work item is going to. What I find is usually more successful is to map something that doesn't require as much knowledge. So the way I think about it is, I should be able to hire anybody off the street who knows IT to be able to support my users and get things to the right place if they can pick a classification from a list. If they can pick a classification from a list, then it needs to be able to then get to the right resolver group. Now, will that be 100% accurate? Not necessarily, but it will be very accurate because I'll know that these work items are getting to people who I've already defined are going to be aligned with that classification. So it's a combination of the feed of the incident through the call, portal, or IM to the service desk. What we're usually finding is that we're shifting more to the service desk, and less to individual analysts in the field. Service desk allows us to aggregate what is the experience we're delivering to our customers, and allows for the people in the field to focus on serving the customers as a tier two or tier three. If I can help the service desk resolve those incidents, then I don't have to be doing it in the field. If I can then move from the service desk to self-service, then I'm delivering an even better experience to my users. Okay, so there's two different types of incidents. One is my grill, and the other is a gigantic fire, right? So on the left-hand side, we see a grill fire, which some people might think is really, really critical. Like, this is my world, and it's a problem. I can't address cooking burgers tonight because I have a massive grill fire. But it's certainly less important than this entire business burning down. So in the sense that we have this, in this case that we have this entire business burning down, there's a different kind of incident process that a lot of companies put in place, and it's called a major incident process. And the major incident process facilitates us getting the people on the phone and getting people working on an incident in very intentional ways. What you'll find is that anybody can put out the grill fire. So I could probably go get a fire extinguisher, and I could put out the grill fire, right? And I don't need a lot of coordination, and I don't need my wife telling me to put out the grill fire because I already know it's a grill fire and I can go do it, right? However, in this office fire, I probably need an incident commander. I need someone who's going to help me to be able to organize the troops who are doing the putting out the fire action and help them to be effective because he's got the big picture view, right? So the incident commander allows for us to be able to organize a group of people who are putting out this fire in an effective way. One person is doing communication. Another person is working on the incident. Don't bug them. They're over there working on the incident. There's another person who's working on understanding the impact. So you got these individuals sort of broken out, and the incident commander is sitting here making sure everything's happening properly. So in a smaller organization, you'd be like, man, I've got like 8 IT people. Why do I need an incident commander? Like, you might find that some of those roles might reside in one person. But you'll find that oftentimes when you're trying to troubleshoot something, you're not really effective at going and communicating to the rest of the business that this service isn't functioning. So having this procedure defined helps you to be much more effective with it. Service request fulfillment is something I see often split from incident management. Service request fulfillment allows for us to define new things I want. So I'll just give you an example of service request fulfillment, okay? So service request fulfillment would be something like, I go out to Amazon to buy a shoe. So if I go out to Amazon to buy a shoe, I am interested in a brown shoe that's a slip-on, because I don't like tying laces, and it's got to fit my foot. It's a 10 inch, size 10, and it's got to be here by Tuesday. So I'm going to go out there and go through this ordering process. And throughout that process, they're interacting with me, and they're also setting expectations. They're saying, here's the colors of shoes that I have. Here's the sizes of shoes I have. You can't have 10 and 3 quarters. You can have 10 and a half, or you can have 11 or 10. That's what you get. So it allows for me to set expectations to my customer that they then start to function inside. It also lets me set expectations regarding when it's going to get there. How would you feel if you went out to buy shoes and the first time you ordered it got there in 3 days, the next time it showed up in 14, the next time after that it showed up in 1? How would you feel about that? You'd unreliable, right? You'd always want the 1, and if you didn't get it in the 1, you'd probably start calling because you'd be like, I want it now, I want it now, I want it now. And the only way to manage it is for me to get angry and to call someone up and talk to them about it because they didn't set expectations with me. If they told me it'd be there in 3 days, I could have planned around it being there in 3 days, but they didn't. So when we build portals, what do? We put a request out there that becomes a black hole with the box of IT. Or they send an email and say, send in a request and sent through email and I'll respond to it. And then we don't get back to them the first time, and the second time, and the third time, and then we're busy. I mean, we're legitimately, I'm like, man, how can they need this done in 3 days? They can never get it done in 3 days because we haven't set expectations with them. So our goal always need to be to set expectations. Even with automation, we set expectations because there might be a process element. Okay, so service requests. These are somewhat obvious, right? We've got things like new users and permissions accesses. We've got new workstations, device, cell phones, asset changes, server requests, you name it, right? This is where we can get really creative. There's all sorts of things to automate and do service requests around. This is one of the really cool things about IT is there's a lot of ways for us to serve people. Problem management is about figuring out root cause. So how many conversations in IT go like this? We can't fix it today. Put it on the things to do list. Who has a things to do list? Some of you, right? I think a lot of people don't even have, they have a mythical things to do list. Like this mythical, it's funny, like I have 5 kids and when we tell them that they have this thing, when they're fighting over a toy, I say you can have it for 2 minutes, right? The 2 minutes is like this mythical 2 minutes. Like as far as they're concerned, it's this like unknown period of time when I'm going to be able to have this toy, 2 minutes, okay. So I can kind of let 2 minutes stretch on, or I can kind of let 2 minutes get faster. I have control over the 2 minutes, right? The things to do list is sort of like the mythical 2 minutes of parenting. So we want to take the things to do list and make it something actually effective. So problem management becomes a things to do list. It becomes a list of things that I want to address sometime, somewhere. So when you say, oh, use the 10% of your time that you have left over after you're doing incident management to work on your things to do list, you're like, what 10%? But then after you get done with the 10%, you're like, okay, good. Here's my prioritized list of things I'm working on. Is this appropriate? I'm working on number one. They say, wait, no, that's not right. I want all of them. Then you're like, no, I can work on number one because that's the amount of time I have available. We need to hire a guy to work on more of these. So once you articulate a list, it really helps people get across that IT is not a black box anymore. It's a group of people who are working feverishly to help serve them, and we now have a list of things that we're working against. It also feeds projects and change requests. So once I figure out a solution to the change to the problem, it then feeds into the change request that lets me serve my customers. Self-service. Sometimes people think that self-service interfaces are the end-all be-all of the world of IT service management. And they're nothing without expectations. Just like that Amazon example. If they didn't tell me when my shoes are getting there, I'm probably not going to order from Amazon.com anymore. I'm going to order from somebody else because they didn't tell me when my shoes are going to get there. So make it easy to use. Make it look like a public site where you're selling your services that they're going to get from you. Don't, here's a critical aspect of this. Don't send your customers down a path and then have them come back up the same path. Always give them the ability to be able to address their issue once they've gone down that path. So if they're going down a path which is a service request path, let them open an incident when they get to the end of it. Don't make them come back out. Let them always get to the end. Sometimes people will say, like, I don't like having 3 different boxes I gotta click on and go through an incident process. People don't like it because they don't have good content. So when you start building in good content, people are like, okay, this actually makes sense because this is helping me. So the depth of your content is what allows your self-service portal to be effective. Okay. So let's show a couple examples of this. Okay. This is just a quick example of an IT portal. And on this IT portal, I'm just going to show you a couple of key things. We've noted the change requests that exist. This is all in Office 365, by the way. So we've put it all in Office 365 because that's the reason why we did that is because a lot of organizations are finding that they put everything else in Office 365, they put everything else in SharePoint, one of the two, right, on-premise or Office 365, and they want IT to be there too. And the cool thing is we can leverage that information. So once it's in Office 365, I can actually leverage that same information on other sites so that data becomes really relevant. So I've got announcement data out there. I've got my change calendar published out there where the changes that are flowing through the system exist. I've got some information about the IT organization, my requests, and so on. And then I have a process for server provisioning. So for server provisioning, what I've done is I've tried to make it really, really easy. And I've built out standard, professional, enterprise, and then we have our CPUs that are associated with them, the hard drive that's associated with them, and then the OS that it's going to get. And then we give them a standard build summary with contact information for questions, should have when they're going to get it. I broke my own rule. And then we have the ability to actually go forward with ordering that particular request. The idea behind it is I'm trying to make this experience very much like how they would consume it if they were going to get it from a public ordering portal. I could also use WAP for a very similar thing. There's actually some really good Service Manager plugins for Windows Azure Pack that allow for you to surface some of that data. So the idea is we want to build an ability for my users to be able to experience self-service in a way which is centric to the way they want to consume it. So I've built out different ways of getting data out here, as well as the change calendar itself. So we're surfacing that data in a kind of easy-to-use portal interface for people to be able to experience. But putting it all in Office 365, where they have the rest of their data as well. Another thing I might be interested in doing is judging incident category data. Someone definitely made a change. Or more reports weren't updated. Okay. Let's go. Ah, that's why. Okay. Well, I'll come back to that, which is totally cool. All right. Next opportunity that we have is continuous improvement. Continuous improvement is about taking the outputs of our service process and feeding that into changes that we're making. Plan, do, check, act. So I'm going to walk through some of the metrics that we should be measuring in our data centers. And these metrics are ones that if you don't have them, I'd work on being able to provide those metrics out to the business. Okay, first metric is first level resolution. First level resolution means when the first person got the call, what percentage of my incidents were resolved by that person? Is it greater than 50%? Is it under than 50%? First level resolution is a very valuable thing. It allows for me to be able to serve my users in a very effective way by having them call and immediately get resolution with their incident. I want to increase that. So that's a judgment that I can place upon myself. I can say, all right, I'm doing a really good job at first level resolution, or I'm not doing such a great job. The next is mean time to repair. Mean just means average, okay? Just for all those non-statisticians. Average time to repair, I guess we could say. How long were my incidents open on average? Am I meeting my expectations or am I not? Number of routes per incident. So this is a great opportunity for you to change your customer experience. My average routes per incident is over 3. That's a pretty bad customer experience. If my average routes is under 3, that means I'm doing a pretty good job. It means I went from the service desk to a resolver and they resolved it. If it's over 3, it means they went from the service desk to a resolver to another resolver. If it's over 3, that means more than a substantial number of my incidents are actually going service desk, resolver, 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 because it has to average, right? So the goal's got to be under 2, or be under 3, be in that 2 range. The lower you get it, the happier users will be. Customer satisfaction. Funny story. So we're a consulting company, right? So every year, Microsoft makes us do these CSAT surveys. So And you have to be at like a certain percentage to get points to be a Microsoft partner. So we used to send out customer satisfaction surveys, and we'd be like, don't send out the survey to those people. They weren't really happy. So you're choosing who to send surveys to. You wouldn't believe how many times I run into customer satisfaction survey things internal to companies where they let the service desk technicians decide who they're going to survey and who they're not. Like, what is that doing for me, right? Like, how is that determining how effective I am? That's just determining how good my service desk people are at picking. So the idea behind this is we want to be able to define how well we're doing and then let them give us feedback. So when we do that, it allows us to be able to give our users a great experience and then understand whether or not they're having a good experience with IT. So customer satisfaction surveys will improve your satisfaction, your customer satisfaction with you, because you're telling them that you're interested in their feedback. And you're going to get some really interesting feedback if you let them give you comments. And it will make you be better. SLT violations. Service level target. I should have just put a service level target. Service level target violations are, where did I miss my promise that I had for them? I'm promising something to my users. Where did I miss the promise? Availability. What did I achieve? 99.9, 95%. You know, what exactly did I achieve with my users? Cost. Do my business priorities align with IT spend? That's an interesting question. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Business priorities, if they don't align with IT spend, leads to black box syndrome. It leads to, I'm pouring all sorts of money in IT, and I don't see what I'm delivering to my customers getting better. It doesn't help me deliver better for my customers. And this is something that we need to change. Okay, so where do you start? If you're starting with metrics, what are the things that I should start with? The first metric to start with would be resolution time. Resolution time defines how long are my incidents open. Don't start with response time, start with resolution time. Because that's what you're trying to promise. Routes, how many times do I route? What's my availability? If you start with resolution time and routes, I guarantee you improve your customer experience. You add availability, that's going to be really helpful because it's allow you to track against the service. Basic cost allocation lets you define whether or not your spend aligns with your priorities. Okay. All right, back in business. So this is an example of a Power BI report based on service costing. So what I did is I took all my services, so for example, collaboration, customer ordering, and I aggregated the different costs. So you can see on the right-hand side, we have staff allocation costs, monthly hosting costs. So if I want to say, all right, show me all the staff allocation costs. Show me the monthly hosting costs. I've broken those down. Somebody asked me, where do I get this cost data from? Staff allocation, you just take a basic number and you allocate it against your staff. So you don't like try to say, oh, this guy's paid this much, this guy's paid this much. You just take a basic number that you want to allocate as an internal costing against your staff, and you allocate it against that all your users, and then you allocate that against work. And you use the work to be able to define on average what it's doing against a particular service. Is that always, you know, accurate to 99%? No. Is it accurate to maybe 80%? Yeah. So you get good enough data. Monthly hosting costs, service costs, software. Hosting is going to be something, it's going to be a configuration item in the CMDB. Service costs would be very similar to that, like an external service cost, like an Office 365 service cost. Monthly software is an asset cost, and then project investments. So I might say, all right, customer ordering services. Why are my project investments so small in customer ordering services? That's one of my most important deliverables. Whereas network connectivity services seems like it's costing me a lot more money, over $250,000. Why is it costing me that much? And why are my investments so high there? What you might be able to say is because I've moved so many things to the cloud that this is required for this. So you can have that conversation now, right? You could say, look, here's where I'm at. I can't reduce this without hurting this. However, you know, we're not investing more in email services, but we probably should invest more here. Maybe that's where I get some more money because I'm starting to be transparent. This isn't just a black box on the screen anymore, right? I'm not just saying, trust me, I need $650,000 for this new thing. It's I'm trying to be transparent with the business about how I spend my time and my money. Statistics on deliverables are similar. Collaboration services, you can see, has a lot of SLO breaching. So my team in collaboration services might not be as good at serving my customers as these other users are. All right. You can do similar things with incident category data. So you might say error card or smartphone and get different types of data based upon what people are trying to accomplish. All right. So I got to close down. Don't be a black box. Be a service provider for your business. We've launched a new community site, itoolforitpros.com. Go join the conversation. It's not a sales site. It's not for selling, buying something. It's just a community site. So join the conversation. Become part of the conversation. If you're an expert, register yourself as an expert and join our conversation about how we can be better at delivering IT. Thank you.